Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, September the 24th. How long do you want to live? Are you planning on making it to 100? And not 100 lying in a nursing home bed, but 100 years old in good physical and mental shape? Is that possible? Our guest this hour says yes, and then some, not just 100. He says in the coming decades, the typical lifespan could very well be 125 years old. And as time goes on, the lifespan will also lengthen to 300 or 400 years old, possibly indefinitely. Our guest says we are on the threshold of a super longevity era. A super longevity revolution, where a senior citizen will look and feel as young as their great-grandchildren, where medical breakthroughs and new technology will allow people's physical appearances and health to remain young, even as their age climbs way past 100. Are you curious as to how this could be? Do you believe it? Is this something you desire? What will it do to life as we know it? We will welcome your thoughts and questions about the prospect of super longevity. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Michael Zay. He's a futurist, a sociologist, a professor of management at Montclair State University, and he is director of the Expansionary Institute. He has written other books, two previous books on longevity and lifespan, The Future Factor and Seizing the Future. His most recent book, which we will focus on this hour, is Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
So let's say the median age of our listeners in our audience right now is 54, and that's about right. How old will those of us today who are around that age, you know, 50, 55, how long are we going to live?
Well, you know, one of the nice things about aging is that the longer you live, certainly according to actuarial tables, the longer you will live. It would not be out of the question for a sizable portion of your audience to live into their late 80s, 90s, and doing the right thing, certainly into the early 100s, and that's without any of the breakthroughs that I talk about in the in the book. That's just by living good and basically benefiting from the technologies that we have currently.
Yeah, what I'm wondering about is I think I've read that for a woman, I think it's about 80 now, isn't it? The average lifespan is 80
in the United States.
In the United States,
it's gone into the into the early to mid 80s in Japan and some countries like that.
But what I'm wondering is if this you know, all these advances in technology and medical breakthroughs are happening right now. You know, when I'm 80, maybe there's hope for me to go well beyond that.
Well, certainly, people in the futurist and the super longevity research area, one of their watchwords is "Hang on for two more decades," and you'll probably see a lot of the benefits that they're talking about and that we're talking about, and that's what they think is the realistic time frame for these developments to kick in. So absolutely, if one is average age 50, 54, which would mean you're kind of mid-boomer age right now, I would think that if you just want to stay for a long time and do so in a relatively healthy way, yes, these people will be seeing most of these benefits. In fact, the benefits are occurring so quickly that, in a way, it's almost stunning because, you know, if you follow this, just within the last few days, there was an announcement that one of the companies called Certus, which looks at genetics and genetic bases of aging, thinks that they've come across some very interesting findings, which in some way they hope will be turned into a pharmaceutical that will not only extend life, but be able to treat a number of diseases simultaneously. Now, will that happen? We don't know. But one of the things that I'm struck with is how many different fields and how many different researchers are looking at this and coming up with what at least theoretic solutions for what they call the disease of aging.
No. What's in this pill?
Well, this goes back to one of the things that stunned me, and one of the reasons I wrote Ageless Nation was I've written books on technological growth and what I call hyper progress. I've written Seizing the Future and books like that, which kind of embrace the whole idea of technological progress. And you know, you look at developments in energy and different areas, and you kind of see what kind of advancements are taking place. But one of the areas that struck me was and one that I thought was going to have immediate ramifications in our society, and probably the greatest, was the extension of human life, and also the enhancement of the human shell, the physical, our physical being. And the more I started to investigate this, the more I realized that there are some of these people coming at the issue of super longevity from kind of obtuse and arcane areas, and one of them that stunned me is this area called caloric restriction.
Mm-hmm.
We've been working over the last at least 70 years. They've discovered, sometimes inadvertently, that if you reduce the calorie intake of animals, mice in most cases, but a variety of other animals, you can extend the lifespan into what would be equivalent in human terms of 140, 150, 160 years old. And they're not exactly sure why, but they've kind of zeroed in on this as kind of an interesting way to approach super longevity. And one of the what I found fascinating is that the mice, when they did die, which would be whatever 2 or 3 years old, human equivalent 150, 160 years old, that they were dying in good shape, which actually led mm-hmm. us to the question of why they died at all. They didn't have all of the plaques that are associated with Alzheimer's. They didn't have cancers, and for one who can discern the differences, they looked young. What a young looking mouse is, you know, most of us probably wouldn't be able to tell, but the researchers were able to see this, and this pill is actually based, the hope is that we can develop some type of pharmaceutical, some type of pill that will mimic this activity of caloric restriction, so that we would actually be able to, in a sense, get the body and the cells to do all the things that it's doing when you radically reduce your calorie intake.
Yeah.
And which means one could have the benefits without having to go through the diet. The fasting that it's really almost fasting.
Yeah.
It's very low, and the ability to knock out all of these diseases at the same time would obviously be something like the holy grail of aging. And think that they're coming this close. This particular company, I'm not saying they've reached it, but the every time you think the progress is 10 or 20 years away, it moves closer.
Yeah, I'm certainly, many of us are familiar with that caloric restriction research because it's a UW-Madison researcher who's heavily behind it. I just saw a feature on people who are trying to do this, and you really are, they look pretty thin.
I'm not sure what the equivalent is, but anywhere from some people have said it's as low as high as in the thousands of calories. Others say it's really more like 750 to 800. And anyone who's actually gone on a diet and tried to stay down there every day, it's a challenge. I mean, you have to really be careful. And one thing I should mention, of course, and your listeners probably know, those mice and other animals that are on the restriction diet, they ensure that they're receiving nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, so that they're getting the other nutrients in one form or another that they need. But that's just one way we're approaching it. And, will we wake up one morning and discover that there is this pill? It's hard to say. I mean, antibiotics came on society fairly quickly. I mean, once they started to develop them, you know, within 10, 15 years, it was just, you know, it was just what you got at your local pharmacy. And that changed our lives dramatically. So mm-hmm. it's it's really a question of how quickly we get there. And one of the things I thought we're getting there so quickly is that's why I wrote Ageless Nation, because I was really more concerned about the implications of this radical life extension and what it's going to do to our institutions. And in a sense, we're going through this right now, which is another reason I wrote the book, because as I point out in the book, we really went through the first phase of super longevity in the last century when we upped our average lifespan from, say, the 40s into at what we have now, currently near 80. And that has already brought on certain social issues. It certainly has brought on a lot of issues for individuals who suddenly find themselves after retirement facing the decades that perhaps they were not planning for. And, it's a good news, bad news kind of thing, because a lot of people find themselves in that, that super longevity revolution, and society has not answered questions yet about what we're going to be doing with ourselves and the impact it's going to have.
Well, we'll talk more about those impacts in just a moment, and welcome questions for our guest, Michael Zay, futurist, sociologist, a professor at Montclair State University. Talking about his new book, Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. Why are we on this quest anyway? Do we want to live forever? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned all day long for talk about issues that matter to you. Coming up after 3 o'clock, it's Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders with Gene Faraca. Gene will talk with one of the world's leading environmentalists who discusses something that's going right with the world, a worldwide movement determined to heal the wounds of the earth. She talks with Paul Hawken after 3 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking with the author of Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection, who says that with the help of a plethora of medical breakthroughs, including genetic engineering, cloning, nanotechnology, bionics, new drugs to combat cancer and other diseases, we will soon push life expectancy into the 125-year-old range. And by the year 2100, we can expect to live to ages of 300 and 400 years, possibly indefinitely. What do you think of this, and what is this going to do about life the way we know it? What is this going to do to society? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Did I read that right? By the year 2100, we can expect to live to maybe 400 years old or more?
Yes, and that's if the breakthroughs take place, even beyond the pharmaceuticals and caloric restriction diets that we discussed. If the breakthroughs take place in nanotechnology, which have not happened yet, regardless of what the media says, and we would really be looking at it at a time where we could be regenerating body parts and basically keeping cells going for much longer than even a caloric restriction diet with the help of pharmaceuticals would get us to. And that, of course, would be in upending the social revolution. The one positive about all of this, and what ensures the transition, a smoother transition than one would actually think, is that if you think about it, if we reach the potential for 400 years of lifespan, say in 2100, it still will take 400 years or 200 years for us to begin to start to notice that people hanging around long, much longer than they actually were. So it when we talk about extended life, it's life potential. I mean, if one takes the average age of at death in 2100, it's not going to be 400. Obviously, these people would have to have been living for hundreds of years. So it's all pushed into the future. But we kind of get the idea when we see people not getting older, and that people not getting ill, that we're talking about extremely long lifespans. So there would be kind of a, before you'd have all those demographic issues of people living that long, you'd certainly have the psychological changes that would be taking place, where people suddenly begin to realize that this is, they're in for a very long haul if they want it. if they so desire.
Yeah, do we want this?
It's an interesting question, and I've asked audiences all over the United States, and I said, would you want to live to 125 or 150? And you get a lot of nays until you say, in a body of a 32-year-old, mm-hmm. suddenly it's of course, because what they're envisioning is people getting infirm. And, you know, that as one ages, or as one progresses through the lifespan, shouldn't even use the word aging because it conjures up ideas of infirmity. As one progresses through the lifespan, in that scenario, if you were living as a young person, they start to see it very differently, and suddenly they would love to live longer. I mean, most people who are healthy do not want to continue living. I mean, they're just interviewing someone who's 104, and you know, his scenario is, I want to live forever, and I'm going to do it. Well, you know, that's his personal views, but that, you know, he's not saying, gee, my, you know, and the worst part about it is, for someone living at that age now, is not so much the physical, but it's the social dislocation. All my friends are gone. I've out-survived everybody, including most of my children. You know, that has a certain type of, that alienation from the immediate environment, because you don't have your peer group of any type. You know, even you don't even have people who lived through the eras that you did. That's going to change, though, as more and more people push themselves to those greater ages, because you will have your peer group. You certainly will have your children, and there'll be you know, really a multi-generational approach to things, as opposed to someone who is just out there on the outlier on the demographic charts.
Yeah, you know, we're going to get into the implications, the impact of all of this in just a moment, but trying to get to the, when you say that this technology and these medical breakthroughs are going to make it possible for us to be 125 years old and look and feel as young as our great-grandchildren, what kind of research is going on now that would allow that to happen?
The research in nanotechnology, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the two things. Even the caloric restriction diets, if that actually breaks, if those breakthroughs actually take place, and you know, as I said, it seems like we're getting closer to that. That would actually, the only way that can actually work is if the cells don't age. I mean, that's what it's actually preventing. So if the cells aren't aging, you will look younger than you actually do. The other approach, which I see as very promising, is the nanotechnological approach. And nanotechnology is building up matter, essentially, from the ground up, atom by atom. We haven't gotten to that yet. When you hear about nanotechnology referred to in the media, very often what you're hearing about is scientists shrinking things down to the nano level, which is infinitesimal. This is actually building things up from the very basis of atoms. So, as they describe it, you could have a pile of soot and use that, the atoms in that, to recombine it into almost anything, including body parts, etc. So then you're talking about the possibility of even rejuvenation, what they call dechronification, which you would actually be setting the age of cells backwards, which is kind of a complex process. But that's the kind of technology that's taking place. Mm-hmm. So even if the breakthroughs occur within that are necessary on caloric restriction, which seems, if not imminent, certainly within, conceptually possible, and nanotechnology, which needs conceptual breakthroughs to actually get us to the next stage, that's where you would actually be looking at people looking younger. Yeah. This is without cosmetic surgery now. This is talking mm-hmm. about actually keeping the cells young.
To the phones we go. Mary in Madison is with us. First, hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is so fascinating, and it just has set my mind worrying to so many different areas. But one of them that I have to wonder about is if I'm in a 32-year-old body, but I'm actually 125 years old or 150 years old, am I still able to procreate? And what does this say about population explosion and the sustainability of the planet if there are so many more people because we're aging and et cetera, and living longer, what does that do? And I'll just take your comments off the air. Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. Thank you.
All right. First, will the 125-year-old woman be able to have babies?
Well, we know that a 63-year-old just had a baby. Now they were not using they were using the current marvels of technology, which is using an egg, a borrowed egg, and it involved technology. She was not really conceiving, quote unquote, with her body, but she had the baby. It went to gestation in her body. And she had that baby, and she was able to do this. We see it's not uncommon now for people in their 40s to be able to do that. And the scenario of the person not aging would mean that they would be retaining their functions, including the ability to procreate. Now, if a woman could do that, would she do that at different ages? What I try to point out is that most of what we think of as the lifespan and life cycle changes dramatically if we don't physically age, or if we age much slower than we're doing now, because we're able to accomplish things, procreation being one of them, physical feats that we thought were basically the territory of somebody 28 would be now available to somebody 68. And you know, we're approaching that from different vantage points also. I mean, with hormones and other types of technologies even now. But if the breakthroughs take place where we literally do not age because of the cells are just not aging, that allows us to do these things at those later ages, which means that one of the things I point out in the book is that so much of how we react to people is based on what we see when we encounter them. I encounter a stranger looks 50 or looks 70 versus looking 18. We all think we treat people equally, but we don't. We treat people with a certain amount of deference when they're older. We treat people who are younger. We have certain expectations of their knowledge base, of their experience base, and we interact and react to them that way. That's going to be thrown completely out the window when people start to look young who have the accumulated wisdom of 70, 80, 90 years old, of 90 years. We may start off by reacting to them as though they have the psyche of a 20-year-old, but in reality, the person may have the physique of someone who's 60 or 70, but they're going to come at us with a lot more experience. And they, you know, they might be the CEO or a Supreme Court judge or someone at that level and look 25. So the way we interact, I think, is over time is going to reshape our behavior because, quite frankly, you don't know how old people are.
Yeah, that is amazing. So I'm sorry.
Well, that will both liberate us and befuddle us at the same time.
But if what are we going to? What's the average that we're going to look at? When do we stop that process where the wrinkles? I mean, will we have the wrinkles, or will that be stopped by this?
Well, that's a good question because some of these technologies can get you. Seem to be suggesting you could get back. Others say that it will become effective at the moment that you start, at the day you start using it, and you won't get any older. But it's not going to make you younger than you were at the time you started. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what happens to society over time when they have these, you know, these super pills that are going to give you super longevity, but you know it's going to keep you young simultaneously? And I think a lot of people will be drawn to that, not so much because they're going to live to 130, but that because they're not thinking a century down the line, but that it can stop the aging process at this time. So that's a great question. At what point do people wake up and smell the coffee and say, look, if I don't do it now, I'm going to continue to look older, and everyone, this society looks so much younger.
I guess what we're seeing here is that we're not going to see eventually, decades and decades from now, just everybody looking 35.
No, but people will stop. We'll do it. They have to stop that. Now, that's based, of course, on access to the technologies, which is another issue completely, because people have to know about them. And then they have to go and, you know, they have to have, I suppose, the money for it and, you know, be financially, you know, regardless, based on how much it costs, but also be aware of it and have access to it. Yeah. And that there might be that kind of a stratification taking place in society But eventually, I'm predicting it will become the norm. And if people can stop the aging process, they will do it. And it'll be what we can predict is it'll be a younger looking society. Mm-hmm. Than it is now. I think we're a younger-looking society anyway than we were 100 years ago for a lot of different reasons, you know, including the way that we haven't had to combat diseases that were ravaging mm-hmm. through society, and nutrition and all of these other areas, just having a different type of lifestyle that has allowed a person who's 50 or 60 to look 40 or
right.
45. So that's already changing, but when we're talking about actually stopping this at a fairly young age, with the abilities and of that age, which is also something that changes what people do. I mean, the whole occupational structure, in a lot of ways, still is based on physical and mental abilities,
yeah.
And that will change it also. So that was the first part of it.
Right, and I wanted to, we don't want to overlook her other thing, talking about whether this is going to increase populations and overpopulation and what about all that?
Right, well, the overpopulation issue, and I know this is extremely controversial, and I'm going to say it anyway. We have had fears of overpopulation since we hit our first billion, which is around the time that Malthus was writing his famous tract about how we were going to quickly outdistance, population was going to quickly outdistance the food supply and was going to lead to starvation, etc. And we've had this kind of clarion call for restrictions on population growth at almost every juncture, at the 3 billion level in the 1960s, and certainly as we're getting up to 6 billion, 6.5 billion now at the world population. And at this point, we're certainly not outdistancing food, because what was a malnutrition problem a few years ago has turned into a global obesity problem, mm-hmm. even in poorer countries, where obesity now is seen as more detrimental or as detrimental as malnutrition was, because it's bringing on a host of diseases. The other issue I'd make is, and the other point I make, you have to realize at this time that there are many countries that are essentially paying their citizens to reproduce, that the population problem that defined in places like Estonia, certainly in France, Germany, in many countries, is not overpopulation by any means. It's underpopulation, and they because of the they're reproducing at well below the replacement rate, and now they have to find ways through tax breaks, bonuses, you name it, to actually induce people to have children. So when we talk about population, it's not as simple as we thought. You know, it's not that we're suddenly overproducing ourselves. The second question about population is, would people keep producing and reproducing as the lifespan expanded? They might, but people do still, what goes into the decision to have children, more than two, three children, there's the costs associated with having children, there's the effort that's involved with bringing and raising children. So those will still mitigate the increases in population. But there's no doubt about it. If you start to reduce the death rate, we will have some increases of some type that are essentially attributed to that. Would it lead to overpopulation? I have one of the people that argues that overpopulation is not a definitive concept. It's a concept in relation to your resources and your ability to produce.
Well, even if it doesn't lead to overpopulation, what about other implications on our environment? We've had a couple of emailers and callers who are wondering about that.
Well, about the environment. The environment to me is something that can be solved. And I've dealt with this in other books about the impact of industrialization and all these issues about pollution. To me, the answer to these is technological. It's not reducing the number of people. It's coming up with ways to technological and scientific ways of dealing with environmental issues. Will we run out of things? You know, it doesn't seem at this point that we're running out of they've been predicting since the 1980s that we were going to have mass starvation by the mid-80s. We're going to run out of oil and all of these basic commodities. I don't see it happening at this point. Now, we always have the ability to replace, say, oil with other types of resources. In fact, I think we're dragging our feet in terms of developing nuclear power, certainly nuclear fusion. We should be having more hydrogen and used in automobiles, and all of this is possible. And when I say we're dragging our feet, it seems like we should have reached some of these goals already. And I apply that to other types of commodities. We find replacements for them. So if the issue is running out of things, certainly food is not an issue at this point. I mean, we have as much. You know, we're producing food because of the genetic revolution and biotech. We're producing. In fact, I'm sure certain farmers in the Midwest would say we're overproducing in terms of the impact on prices. So, I don't see population pushing us to these dire circumstances that a lot of people have said. I mean, if we got to from 6 million to 10 million, would it 10 billion? Would it really start to have the impact on every environmental issue that we have. I really don't believe that's true. Yeah. I also say, you know, and this is one of the bases of this expansionary theory that I've been I had developed something called the imperative of growth, where I see growth as very important, not just population growth, but technological, economic growth, etc., very important to human progress. And I really see every individual person that comes on the planet as potentially value added. That is, that person can produce, has the potential, and we know this to be the case, has the potential to produce more than they consume. So they grow the pie more than they deplete it. Yeah. And we've seen that in terms of productivity charts, and people just produce a lot. And that you never know which one is going to be the next Einstein that will then lead to some breakthrough, which will, again, solve a host of societal issues.
I'm past a break time. Let me remind listeners, we are talking with Michael Zay, who's a sociologist, a futurist, a professor of management at Montclair State University, director of the Expansionary Institute. He is the author of the new book, Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. Wondering if you would like to live to be 125 years old or more in good physical and mental shape? Michael Zay says it's not that far off when we can expect that the human lifespan will last at least that long. And we welcome your questions and thoughts for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And what will this do, this super longevity revolution, this super longevity era, what will this do to the world and our lives as we know them? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. You're listening to The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, it's Kathleen Dunn. All things political coming up after 9 o'clock. She'll be talking with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about everything that happened in the world of politics in the past week or so. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking with the author of Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. He is Michael Zay, and our next caller, we'll try to get to as many callers as possible now, Gary in De Pere. Hi, Gary, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments. So one, I suspect this will only be available to the very unique among us. And number two, some time ago on the People's Pharmacy and Public Radio, they mentioned an experiment in Wisconsin using coenzyme Q10 and alpha-lipoic acid with some startling results, quote. Do you know anything about that?
I don't.
No, I well, refresh
Yeah, I mean, what were the startling results, Gary?
I didn't catch it. That was the end of the quote, and they went on to something else. I forever wondered what that was. I've never sent them any emails or anything, but maybe I should.
Yeah. There were startling results, and it was not carried throughout the media. They should share it.
Yeah, in any case, what about his thought that the technologies and medical breakthroughs will only be available, he said, to the very unique. Maybe he meant the very rich.
Well, mm-hmm. And I think, these technologies will be available as they are today, to people who can afford them. I mean, theoretically, all of us can get, here's a controversial area, the HGH, the human growth hormone, which is being dispensed through clinics legally to people in their 50s in places like California. And the people who are receiving these are claiming that it's reviving them, it's helping their alertness, it's bringing muscle mass back to their bodies, and having all these other wonders, it's helping them occupationally. They're thriving with the injection of these hormones. However, they're paying for all of the hormones between $2,000 on up per month for the advice and for the hormones. It's out of the reach of the average individual at this point. Now, will they synthesize this in such a way that it will become more available? I suspect yes. At one point, the various types of cosmetic surgery, LASIK surgery, was to improve one's eye vision to 20/15. These were just for athletes and for the super rich. Again, it's an economy of scale. As more people get this technology, the cheaper it becomes. And one of the things I should mention, that a lot of this, since it's related in some way to electronics and computers, we know that especially some of the bionic implants, like cochlear implants, which improves one's hearing, it basically brings hearing back to the deaf, is based on transistors and computers. And we know that the price of that always comes down. And in fact, the technology for cochlear implants, the price is coming down.
Yeah.
So it becomes more available. What I'm more concerned about is not the price. It's the issue of the dissemination of knowledge and information about these breakthroughs. We just had an example of it. He mentions a breakthrough that he heard about, and it's not made it into the media. This is one of the reasons I strongly suggest in the book that people become health sleuths, health detectives, in order to gain the advantage here and find where this is being produced and who is at the cutting edge. And a lot of us went through, I think certainly a lot of boomers went through a period where if there was a breakthrough like a vaccine, they just started distributing it through the schools. We all got it, and we had that with the polio vaccine. They eliminated, mm-hmm. for the most part, polio. And we think that that's essentially the way all of these breakthroughs are going to be delivered to us. But I quite frankly, doubt that that's the case. I think these breakthroughs are going to be occurring. These improvements are going to be occurring in pockets around the country and around the world. And some places are going to be more advanced than others, and it's going to take a lot of investigation on the part of the public, individuals, family members, parents, to avail themselves of these breakthroughs.
Right.
And even then, to find, this is one of the reasons. I had just written an article which appeared in the Providence Journal about a week ago, and it's actually been picked up a lot around the world, especially in Asia. Is about medical tourism. And medical tourism was essentially about people originally was about people leaving the country, their country, to find a better price and better service someplace else. But now it's not just to find treatment at an affordable cost. It's also
a new treatment.
Mm-hmm. And we see examples now of Americans, a smattering of them, but Americans going to China to find stem cell advances in stem cells that aren't being applications and therapies, which they are chasing down because they want to cure what ails them.
What do you think, and I do want to get some more callers, but about how politics might stop advances in, say, stem cell research or anything else?
I think it has a profound effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, stem cell research, we see the ethical issues that have emerged, and we see the way that government can either stop funding or it can start to transfer to different directions. That's the funding issue. The question I am more concerned with is the ability of government to actually forbid certain research or forbid the use of certain technologies. And we see this around the world. I mean, you know, we think the United States is just the only one involved with this. But China, for a long time, wanted to ban cloning of any type, cloning of animals. And there is a human cloning ban worldwide at this point. So political, the politics of it is such that it will start to, it will obviously start to drive some technologies underground, and then, you know, people are going to have to start seeking these out, even not only through the internet, mm-hmm. but through word of mouth, to find the types of technologies that can that can help them. I think the eventual debate that's going to take place in society is going to have a tremendous impact. Is first of all, how long we should live. Secondly, how perfect should we get? And you're seeing this take place already. Steroids are illegal. I mean, they're illegal supposedly because they have harmful effects. But soon enough, we will come up with a steroid, and I think they've already found it with HGH. We'll find a hormone that enhances performance tremendously, has, from what we can see, relatively few, if any, impacts, deleterious impacts on the person's body. And all it does is make you stronger than the next guy. That becomes an issue, because then we get into society's question about fairness, about equity, and should one person be stronger than another? I mean, that's the question that's being asked in sports, but you can see it spilling over into everyday life.
Let me take some more callers who have been waiting. John in Mount Horeb. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Assuming humans overcome the biological barriers, has anybody looked at how long we might expect to live just because we'll probably continue driving cars and engaging in other risky behavior, especially, you know, if people live to be 200 years old, they might get a little bored and decide they just have to tackle Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. And I'll hang up and listen.
Mm-hmm.
The issue about getting bored with a long life, people get bored at 30. And I think that a lot of that has to do with one's perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, if you start learning early and start to find interest in your develop your interest early, 200 may seem too short for you in terms of a lifespan. The other question, which dealt with how one approaches this kind of lifestyle, I find it to be a very interesting question. I think we're going to be answering that as a society, and we'll find the answers down the line.
Yeah. Mildred in Menominee is with us. Hi, Mildred.
Hi. My husband had Alzheimer's disease, and I don't think he should have been kept alive any longer than his 86 years. I think that these diseases, this is the one that my children worry about getting. Mm-hmm. And I am 91, or will be next Saturday.
Well, happy birthday.
Yeah. But I don't know that I would want to go on to 124. For one thing, I don't know where the money would come from.
Oh, good point. What about that, Michael Zay?
The financial aspects are such. One of the things I've suggested that we start now is something I call super longevity training, which is we start to train people. Really, it's more than not just training; it's sensitizing people to the reality of living a very long life. A lot of people who are living long today had no idea they would live this long, because when they were growing up, you didn't see a lot of people. You might have seen some, but you didn't see lots of people at 80, 90, 100. Mm-hmm. I mean, centenarians were almost unheard of. The question of preparation and to look at the long haul, look down the long haul, is something I think that people have to start preparing for very early. I think it's going to affect people's the age at which people retire. I think it will affect whether people even ever do retire. And
you talked about having maybe you'll have a career and then you'll have the second career for the last 60 years of your life.
Yes, but that requires you starting to do the training while you're in your other career. I mean, that's one of the things I suggest. You don't have to, but that's certainly, if you're planning it out, you would begin that training either through distance learning or weekend MBAs or something of that, the equivalent to that in whatever the field is, long before you retire. So you'd start to prepare yourself for what you want to do, because people have to look very, even people who are promised retirement income till death do us part with me and my pension fund should still find other methods of support, and just assume that you may need multiple sources of support. Now, again, if somebody is living younger, not even in the age of a 22-year-old, but just physically younger with a minimum of impairments of disease at age 60, 65, and still has the energy of someone much younger, that kind of individual will be able to work and have a second job and a second career. I think our concept of retirement was based on a much shorter lifespan. Certainly that's the way Social Security was planned. People were 63. Living to on average 63 when Social Security was first passed back in the 30s, and the big benefits really started to kick in at 65. So, at that time, Advantage Government, Advantage Social Security Fund, you just take that number and go from 63 to 85, and you can see how that is going to radically change that system. So, we all have to start thinking through the long term. One of the things I think that's important, though, is that I also see us developing what I call the multi-generational family. I mean, it's always existed, but when you have three and four generations living together or living within proximity or certainly interrelating a lot more than they're doing today, I think you have a lot more a chance that the generations will also help each other out, and not just young to old, but vice versa.
Yeah.
The old with money helping the young ones get on their feet, even across two and three generations.
Well, there's lots more to talk about, but we can't do it today because our hour is gone. It's fascinating. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael Zay is the author of Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. Thanks to Karen Prager and to Christina Taylor for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.